The Guardian.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for August the 4th. Coming up, we discuss free will, cognition, and doping at the Olympics with our special guest, the philosopher and expert in neuroethics, Julian Savulescu. Also in the podcast.
One failing that scientists have is that they believe that nothing is going to fool them, because they'll say, wait a minute, I have a PhD. I earned that over several years.
James Randi, no relation, explains the science of illusion and what magic can tell us about the brain. Plus, the exercise drug, water on Mars, and what happens when particle physics meets hip-hop. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Well, it's been a while since I've been in the presenter's hot seat, so please forgive any rustiness as I cover for Alok Jha's summer holiday. He'll be gone for 3 weeks, so I should hopefully get the hang of it by the end of that. Here with me in the pod is Guardian's science correspondent Ian Sample, and he's a man who never takes holidays.
That's correct. Good to see you.
Also here with us is Marcus Pearce of Goldsmiths, University of London, who is a BA Media Fellow and the Guardian Science Desk's summer guest. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, James.
Hello. Our special guest this week, though, is Julian Savulescu, Professor of Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford and a former editor of the prestigious Journal of Medical Ethics. He's just been awarded an £800,000 grant by the Wellcome Trust to help develop the new scientific discipline of neuroethics. Julian, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Could you start by explaining what is neuroethics?
Well, neuroethics is a new field which is examining the ethical controversies that arise from the very radical advances that have occurred in the last decade in the neurosciences. So we're increasingly developing powerful techniques of looking at how the brain functions and also of influencing people's behaviour and choices through things like deep brain stimulation and also transcranial magnetic stimulation. So we now have an unprecedented opportunity to see how the brain is working when people are thinking and making decisions, and also ultimately to influence those thoughts and choices.
So what are the sort of, can you give us some examples of the sorts of questions that you encounter and deal with?
Well, one of the provocative areas or pieces of research that was actually done here in Cambridge, where scientists took people who were thought to be permanently unconscious, and they did some neuroimaging scans of their brain using what's called functional magnetic resonance imaging, basically looking at which areas of the brain are active. Now, they asked these patients who were thought to be permanently unconscious to imagine that they were playing tennis or walking through a room. And in two of the patients, the same areas of their brain lit up as when they asked you or I to imagine those tasks. And that raised the possibility that these people were not unconscious, but there was some level of consciousness going on. So this raises the opportunity to look into the brains of people with severe brain damage to see what their lives are really like and ultimately possibly to communicate with them.
And where does that sort of take us in terms of, you know, what their rights might be or the way we view them as patients?
Well, it's raised some very interesting questions. On the one hand, you might think it's very exciting because these people may, in fact, have conscious thought processes going on, be able to experience pain and pleasure. But on the other hand, they may be leading terrible lives where they're essentially locked in to a body that can't move, that can't interact with other people, and their lives may be a living hell. We simply haven't had the means of communicating with people who are completely locked in this way. And this technology may, for the first time, give us an insight into, once we can begin to communicate with them, just how good or bad their lives are. It may be that this is a reason for better or improved or more aggressive treatment. It may also be a reason for discontinuing treatment.
Another fascinating area that you've looked into is this this area of free will, and to what extent do we really have free will, or is it the case that our decisions are a kind of a summation of our experiences and our genetics, and actually there is no such thing as free will? Where do you sort of stand on that?
Well, there's some pretty radical challenges emerging to the idea that we're free and responsible for our actions. And probably the most provocative experiment, one researcher called Libet found that when people were asked to decide to perform an action, when he measured the brain activity, he found that the areas that associated with motor action were activated before they made a conscious choice to perform some action, which raises the possibility that conscious choice may just be an epiphenomenon. In less perhaps controversial areas, recently a study just came out in Nature that shows that there's clear differences in the way that political conservatives think and reason to make choices to liberals. That's been known for some time. But when these people were asked to perform simple motor tasks, but to change what they were doing, the conservatives had great difficulty changing their plans, just in simple tasks. The liberals were more flexible and able to adapt to changing circumstances and commands. And indeed, both of them had different areas of the brain activated, which suggests that even something like whether you're a political conservative or liberal may not be just a matter of free choice. It may be written into your brain. It may be written into your biology. We know that character traits like neuroticism are associated with strong genetic and biological bases. In one of the studies my group has done in Oxford, we're looking at the association between various ways of making moral decisions and neuroticism, and have found some very provocative findings which have yet to be published.
Ian, you've got a question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about how there's been some research in with people using brain scans to try and improve sort of advertising. I think they call it neuromarketing. And I just wondered if you see any issues coming up on the horizon with that, or whether this is something which is actually quite exciting.
Well, I think there's in all areas of technology, there are upsides and downsides. And as it becomes more powerful, the upsides become greater, but the downsides become greater as well. There's no doubt we will be able to influence people's choices through priming, through a whole range of sophisticated scientific techniques, and influence their choices in a way that advertising has only been crudely doing in the past. By the same token, we'll be able to influence people's choices, or people will be able to influence their own choices to achieve worthwhile goals and perhaps reduce criminal behaviour, perhaps increase self-control and increase people's ability to have a good life. So there are ups and downs.
What kinds of things do you mean when you're talking about advertising? What sort of things do you think might be possible? How will science really feed into advertising there?
Well, as I said, there are a number of studies that have shown that you can prime people. You've also been able to use drugs to influence people's choices, the levels of trust that they have, their willingness to accept unfair offers. So the ability to intervene in biology and to use information cues, various structuring of situations, is going to be able to strongly influence people's choices. I think there's no doubt about that.
Does this tie into your idea of biological liberation?
Well, one of my kind of fun terms is biological liberation. Increasingly, I think the expansion in the understanding of human biology is revealing that many of us face constraints in terms of our ability to achieve our goals or to lead a good life. And as we understand those constraints, we can avoid them, and ultimately we'll be able to intervene in them. To give you one well-known example of something that pretty much affects how our lives go, in the 1960s, a guy called Walter Mischel did a famous set of impulse control experiments. He gave three-year-old children a marshmallow, and he said, if you don't eat this marshmallow when I leave the room, when I come back, I'll give you two. And he left the room, and predictably, some of them just ate the marshmallow, and some of them devised strategies to control their impulses. Now, when he followed these kids up 10 years later, he found that those who could withstand the marshmallow, control their impulses, had more friends, more motivation to succeed, and were more successful. And this feature was more highly correlated with their SAT scores than was their IQ. So the ability to control impulses, delay gratification, is something that affects your life. There's no doubt that there are strategies to improve that. There are already so-called ego depletion studies that look at people's ability to control their impulses, but it's probably written into our biology to some degree, and that we will at some point have strategies to improve impulse control. If you're at the very bottom end of the spectrum, you're highly likely to engage in criminal behaviour and very likely to have low socioeconomic success. So this sort of understanding is going to open up options for people to influence that, not only in themselves but in their children.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. The moral being, keep your hands off that marshmallow. Well, we'll be speaking more with Julian throughout the show, but for the moment, thanks very much. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, Hey Presto, Abracadabra, and Alakazam. We'll discuss the cognitive science behind sleight of hand with magician and arch-skeptic James Randi. First, though, here's Ian and Marcus with a roundup of some of the other stories making the science headlines over the past 7 days.
News Jam.
NASA scientists have confirmed that there is water on Mars. The space agency's Phoenix lander has identified ice in a soil sample analysed by its onboard laboratory. Previous missions had found indirect evidence for water ice, but Phoenix is the first to touch and taste it.
A San Diego company called Sapphire Energy has found a way to use single-celled organisms such as algae as a source of liquid hydrocarbon fuels for cars or planes. When it's burned, the fuel only releases the carbon dioxide absorbed by the algae during its growth, making the so-called green crude carbon neutral.
An ancient Greek computer used to calculate the movements of the sun, moon and planets has been linked to Archimedes after scientists deciphered previously hidden inscriptions on the device. X-ray images of the bronze mechanism, which was recovered from a shipwreck more than a century ago, also revealed a sporting calendar that includes the Olympics.
And finally, scientists are testing two drugs in mice that they claim will reproduce the benefits of exercise in muscles without the hard work. In one experiment, just 4 weeks after administering one of the drugs, the animals were able to run 44% farther than untreated mice, despite not exercising. But couch potatoes shouldn't get too comfortable. Despite nearly a decade of similar work in rodents, efforts to achieve the same results in humans have so far ended in failure. Back to the gym, I suppose.
Thank you, Marcus and Ian. Now let's go down a bit deeper into some of them. Ian, water on Mars. We knew that, didn't we?
Yeah, I've lost track.
How many
of the
times
number
have
of
you
stories
written?
I've written about water on Mars, but you know, let's give NASA their due, and Phoenix also. That Phoenix is obviously NASA's latest Mars lander, has also reported finding water ice on Mars since landing a month or so ago. But the evidence it had before was very indirect. It had essentially scraped away some soil, and one of the cameras had seen essentially a white reflective material, which was not there when they took the same picture a few hours later, and it's sublimated basically because the atmospheric pressure on Mars is so low. So it just evaporated off. But this is, they're saying they're the first to touch and taste, because they've actually put some of this frozen soil with the water ice into one of the onboard ovens and sort of cooked it up to see what's inside it. So we knew there was water there, okay, but it's nice that they're actually analysing it. And what will be really interesting is what is in there apart from water.
Yeah, a bit of organic material would be quite fun to find, wouldn't it?
The whole mantra of NASA's quest for search for life is follow the water. And, you know, the idea being if you find the water, hopefully you'll find some other kind of clue to any sort of sense of habitability in that area. So I'm still interested in this kind of stuff.
And it's worth saying that this story should not be confused with the other water sounding story, water in space type ish story around last week, which was actually not water at all, but on Titan, one of Saturn's moons, the Cassini-Huygens probe found that these dark patches, which looked a bit like lakes, actually are lakes, but they're lakes of ethane. But the temperature on the surface is about -140, so there's definitely no flowing water on Titan. The other one from that lot that I think is fascinating is this idea of an exercise drug or a gym pill that means you don't have to go through all the sweat and tears of building up your body and get all the advantage without the pain. Yeah. What's going on there?
Well, it's one of those stories that you see and you sort of wince but are intrigued at the same time, I think. And I think when you did the reporting on this and spoke to people in the know, that it sort of came clear what the limitations of it were. I think it's really interesting, but it's, as you said in your story, that the implications for humans are probably minimal. And also, you know, this isn't really the answer to the obesity problem, to all range of other health problems that people are having these days. I mean, but anyway,
my understanding is that the physiology hasn't really transferred to humans very well. They just haven't been able to reproduce the same results in humans. Julian, what's your take on this one?
Well, I don't think I agree. I think it this might not be the solution, but there are even more radical possibilities than this. Scientists a few months ago created a mouse they called Super Mouse. They did a very small genetic modification in the glucose cycle, and they created a mouse with the metabolism, supposedly, of Lance Armstrong. The mouse eats twice as much. It's twice as active in the cage. It lives significantly longer. It's got 10% of the body fat, lower cholesterol levels, and it can reproduce to the equivalent of a human age of 80. It runs at 20 metres per second for 5 kilometres. Now, a normal mouse runs 200 metres at that speed. It's significantly enhanced. Humans have exactly the same glucose cycle. If you could change that step in the glucose cycle in humans, you would create superhumans with the same kinds of characteristics. This is not a difficult piece of science. So the reason that these superhumans and supermice haven't existed through human history is we simply didn't have the food resources to fuel such a mutation. It wouldn't have been an advantage. But today we have vast amounts of food for the developed world anyway. There's no reason why we can't create superhumans through genetic modification. So I think that at some point you'll see some very profound changes.
Some people feel pretty uncomfortable about that sort of thing. Why do you think that is? Because you seem to be pretty enthusiastic about the idea.
Well, this is, truly playing God is doing what Craig Venter is doing, where he's creating artificial life from the ground up. But this is pretty close to creating playing God. It's fundamentally changing humans to be in a way that they've never been and would not naturally be, and with striking changes. I mean, again, a couple of months ago, scientists in the US for the first time created a fluorescing human embryo. They transferred genes from a jellyfish into a human embryo, and the embryo fluoresced on the dish. That embryo, if allowed to develop, would create a fluorescent human being. The science is there. But of course, people are very threatened by transferring genes from one species to another, engineering superhumans through genetic modification. My view is that we should consider these changes. Now, being able to fluoresce is not a huge advantage, but being able to live much longer, reproduce much longer, and be more physically robust is an advantage. So the question for me is just do these changes make people's lives go better?
This actually segues quite nicely into something I was thinking we could chat about a bit later on, but with the Olympics coming up, of course, this whole debate about improving human performance either through drugs or through genetic manipulation is obviously, you know, going to be rehearsed again. Your feeling on this, as you've kind of intimated, I think, is along those lines of, you know, why not bring it on for most things?
Well, it's not really why not bring it on. It's what are the reasons for
paraphrasing extremely crudely.
Let's think about what the reasons are for our position. So many people have this view of sport that it's basically a test of biology. Who's got the greatest biological potential, genetic potential to run the 100 metres in the fastest time. Now, if that's your view of sport, yes, taking something that changes biology is against the spirit of that sport. I would be in favour of that view of sport if it were achievable. It's going to be unachievable because of the sophistication of the current doping techniques. There will be people who will use undetectable substances. So my view is, first of all, we need to think what are really our goals in sport. And I think sport is the expression of human physical excellence in some sort of rule-governed activity. Now, if that's what it is, some drugs will enable expression of human physical excellence. So if you take a parallel case, classical musicians, a long time used beta blockers to reduce tremor, to improve performance. Nobody thinks this is against the spirit of music. And likewise, drugs that enable people to recover from injury faster, or even blood doping that's occurred in cycling all through its history, don't seem to be frustrating the expression of human physical excellence. And rather than having the debacle of people being, you know, evicted from the stage, from the winner's podium, or indeed us being completely unsure whether the winner was doping or wasn't, just happened to escape detection, a much more sensible approach would be to take a strategic approach to doping and to allow those substances that are consistent with that sport and are safe enough.
What about the argument that it then becomes a battle between the scientists rather than a battle on the pitch?
Well, if it were a battle between the scientists, then that would be a problem. At the moment, we don't face that problem. Most of the drugs that, for example, steroids only work, and growth hormone only work with extraordinarily hard training. It doesn't just build muscle bulk. What steroids do is they enable recovery as the muscle tears at a greater rate. But you've still got to tear the muscle through training. EPO could easily be used and set a level of blood cells within the blood at 50%, this wouldn't significantly change the competitive nature of cycling. Indeed, it hasn't through cycling history. So we're not faced with the possibility that scientists will be creating humans with 3 metre long legs in the high jump at the moment.
Well, I think there'll be a lot of opinions out there in Podosphere on that one. So if you're interested, please come to the blog and let us know, and also post your comments on the Facebook wall. Well, let's wrap that one up there, but here's a different kind of wrap that Ian managed to find on the web, and it's, well, I don't know, is it disturbing or is it brilliant? I'm going to let you decide for yourself.
27 kilometers tunnel underground, designed with mind to send protons around. A circle that crosses through Switzerland and France. 60 nations contribute to scientific advance. 2 beams of protons being round.
Okay, I think we've definitely had enough of that. Who knew that the LHC was super duper fly? Ian.
Yeah.
Give me your thoughts. Give me your wisdom.
So it's complex, isn't it? Because you want to hate it and you do straight away. But two things that are redeeming about it. I think the woman, and I should know her name, singing in the, I can't handle the Hawking sort of emulated voice, but I think the woman
I'm not sure
singing
Hawking's,
in it,
Hawking's probably not too keen on it either.
Well, I presume it's not. Yeah, I think the woman has a really good voice. I really like her in it. And the best bit about the whole thing is they've sampled the Woo Yeah backing track, which I think is from Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock in 1988, which
You're a child of the 80s, aren't you?
I remember playing at my birthday party with my school friends, and I think it's actually could be an awful lot worse. It does go on too long there.
Yes. In case you're under any illusions, this is about the Large Hadron Collider in CERN in Switzerland, which is going to be switched on in about a month's time. But anyway, enough of that nonsense. To read more about all of these stories, and even if we do say to ourselves the very best analysis of all the news from the worlds of science, technology and the environment, head to guardian.co.uk/science. Now, we often discuss the magic of science here on the pod, but it's about time we got to talking about the science of magic. Did you see what I did there? A new paper published last week in Nature analysed the relationship between illusion and the brain. The authors, a mixture of magicians, cognitive scientists and behavioural neurobiologists, studied conjurers doing their stage acts. They say that there's plenty that brain scientists can learn about intuition, awareness and how to manipulate people's attention. Earlier I spoke to the conjurer James Randi, known on stage as the Amazing Randi, as opposed to me, who's often called the Highly Average Randi. Anyway, he was involved in this research and we began by discussing the art of suggestion.
Any card performer would look for a fatal result if he were to walk on stage, break open a deck of cards and remove it from its pack and say, I have here a perfectly ordinary deck of cards, because the audience might be inclined to believe that perhaps it isn't an ordinary deck of cards. While ordinarily they would simply assume, since he's breaking the seal on the package and shuffling it up and tossing out the guarantee cards or the jokers or something and moving ahead with shuffling it up and not even saying, I'm shuffling the deck of cards, letting them see that, they make the assumption that this is an ordinary deck of cards that the magician is shuffling. And any assumption that they make up their own minds on that, they tend to believe that rather than doubting it. But if they're told it by the magician, who they know has the job of trying to deceive them, for purposes of entertainment, mind you, but still to deceive them, they might tend to doubt it.
One aspect that caught my eye from the paper was this idea of using social cues to make the audience or to lead the audience into an assumption about an action that you're making as a conjurer that may be false. Could you talk us through that a little bit?
The point with social cues is that you tend to look where the magician looks. Now, if I were to have an object, imagine me with an object in my right hand, not concealed. It could be a simple old little ping pong ball or something like that, and I toss it up and down, and I don't mention anything about it. I don't say anything about it. I just toss it up and down while I'm in some other banter with the audience, and I take my right hand, and I'm doing it now in order to try to describe it to you properly, and I transfer that object, the ball, over to my left hand, and I close my left hand. my right hand drops away to my side. But what I left out of that description is that it didn't actually leave my right hand and go into the left hand. What I did was I moved towards my left hand, followed the movement of where I believe the ball and where I want them to believe the ball actually is, and then when I closed my left hand and dropped my right hand to my side, actually the ball was still in my right hand and could then be deposited anywhere, on the table or in my pocket or whatever, because they're all concentrating on my left hand. And so am I. That's the point. The social cue is here that I'm watching where the action is taking place, and they assume that the action is taking place the same place. And when I open my left hand and show it to be empty, they're astonished, and that is how they accomplish the trick. They do it themselves. They make the assumption that my social cue was a valid one.
Do scientists sometimes think about things in a rather a more literal way, or they're not perhaps wise to some of the tricks that conjurers use, and so they can perhaps miss things and are able to learn things from your trade and your perhaps more lateral way of looking at things?
Oh, I think they certainly can, and one failing that scientists have is that they believe that nothing is going to fool them. Because they'll say, wait a minute, I have a PhD. I earned that over several years of arduous study, and I was awarded this PhD. That's a doctor of philosophy. That's a very high degree in the academic world. People aren't going to be able to fool me. But the point is that PhDs are much more easily fooled than children, and that's for a strange reason. Children are not yet sophisticated enough to be fooled. That takes explanation. Children are not yet so experienced with the world that they know that if I take an object in my right hand and I move it over towards the left hand and point to it with the right hand, which still has the object in it, as if the object were in the left hand, that social cue that we just spoke of there, they're not sophisticated enough to know that that's what a person does when the ball is transferred from the right hand to the left hand. They are not experienced enough with the world to know, so they're not smart enough to be fooled. That's a strange way of putting it, but it's quite true. Adults will make that assumption because they've seen that kind of action many, many times. They know how the world usually works, and they make the assumption that it's still working the same way. Children are not that easily fooled.
So, Marcus, as a man with a PhD, do you feel more or less easily fooled?
I feel belittled, humbled.
you were looking into this. You had a blog previous to this particular paper. So there have been two papers in the space of a couple of weeks about using what we can learn in terms of neuroscience from magic. And there were a lot of lovely examples in there, and I love watching these videos of magic tricks being done. But what exactly can you actually learn about the brain?
Well, I think there's two things. I was looking at a paper by Gustav Kuhn at the University of Durham as well. And I think that there's two aspects to it. One is understanding the psychology and the neuroscience behind magic tricks. The other thing is, so these people claim, that magicians can actually contribute to psychology. They say that in some ways magicians are much more advanced in their knowledge of how to deceive people than psychologists are. And as far as I can tell, the examples of the really convincing examples of how that works is that a magician knows how to combine all sorts of different cues in order to misdirect someone's attention, for example. So they can combine social cues with physical cues, whereas psychologists just simply don't have the skill and the knowledge to create these kinds of effects. So that means that psychologists can look at how combinations of cues work. In directing attention, for example.
There's a fantastic video of the great Randy on YouTube. We're talking about his other kind of line of work in debunking charlatans and frauds and people who just engage in hoodwinking the public. And there's one particular bit, I think it looks like it's from kind of the late 70s with Uri Geller on the Johnny Carson's show. And Carson, who's a bit of an amateur magician, apparently went to James Randi and said, what should I do to kind of try and stop Uri Geller from using tricks and to kind of prove that, you know, he's not using the powers of his mind but is actually using kind of trickery? And James Randi says, well, you know, make sure none of his people get to touch any of his props. Make sure he doesn't He isn't able to interfere with them at any time, make sure, you know, he doesn't come on stage carrying anything, all that kind of stuff. And they do that on the show, and it's quite funny to watch, because Uri Geller is sort of there going, I'm just not feeling the vibe today. I can't quite make it happen. And it's he's really squirming in his seat, and Johnny Carson's just looking there going, well, go on, do a trick, go on, bend that spoon. It's just hilarious. So we must put that one on the blog. Before we finish, let's have another chat with Julian Savulescu. What is the future for neuroethics? What are the sort of hot areas that are going to be jumped on by people in the next sort of decade or so?
Well, one is already the development of effective cognitive enhancers. I mentioned modafinil previously. This is a drug which is used by the U.S. Military for its pilots in Iraq, as is a derivative of amphetamines, Ritalin. Many college students are using another derivative called Adderall. So the advent of drugs which improve cognitive performance is here, but will only increase. Scientists are looking at ways of improving memory in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Memory naturally declines after the age of 40. Once those drugs are, you know, developed and are effective, they will be used by ordinary people just to improve memory. So this raises a lot of questions about whether people should have access to these, or indeed whether they should be made widely available. The US military recently said that even a very modest improvement in cognitive performance across the working population would have similar economic benefits to the introduction of the internet. And one study, controversial study, showed that if you just increased everyone's IQ by 3 points, which is about 3%, you would reduce the poverty rate by 20%, and you'd increase productivity in the US by $150 billion per year. Now, even if those are only those are inflated by a factor of 10, there's still very significant benefits on offer. One of the other areas that we're working on,
and just before we move off that one, that's already sort of going on now. In that, a few months ago, Nature had a survey of some of its readers, and a significant number of people were saying that they were using things like modafinil and Ritalin to improve their performance, their cognitive performance, if you like.
Yeah, we talked before about the sort of spirit of sport. I mean, one of the questions we're going to have to face as a society is it cheating if college students, if university students use these drugs in the same way as they use caffeine? And that's a question that we haven't yet addressed. Some of the students will be using them and they will improve performance.
Do you think it's cheating? Or
I again think it simply turns on the safety profile of these interventions, and we don't really know in the normal population of large numbers of people. So I think we need more information before we can say whether they're dangerous. I don't think they're against the spirit of academic performance. Some people have always tried to stay awake for longer and used various strategies to do that. So I don't think it's against the spirit. The question is, why are they safe enough?
Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Thanks very much, everyone. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to all the stories we've discussed today. And leave a little comment there, or maybe on the Facebook wall too. My thanks to Ian Sample, Marcus Pearce, and our special guest, Julian Savulescu. Science Weekly was written by Ben Green and produced by Peter Sale. I'm James Randerson. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.